Hello, everyone. Welcome to another hour of Anti-Media Radio. I am your host for this hour, Jake Anderson. So here we are. I don't really have a set agenda tonight. Got a couple guests I'm working on, one of whom I thought would be joining us tonight. It's looking like we're going to have John Greenwald from the Black Vault on the show probably next week. And for those of you who don't know what the Black Vault is, I recommend you look it up. It's the largest database of declassified files, most of them coming from FOIA requests, which is Freedom of Information Act requests, which anyone can request. If you wanted to right now, you could request that the federal government provide you all documentation of an alien named Bill, and the government would have to look and see. Let's see, do we have any files here about an alien named Bill? And if they do, they'd have to release it to you, and if they don't, they'd have to tell you why, which in that case would probably be, we don't have any files about an alien named Bill. And of course, realistically, a lot of the good shit is not going to be files that could even be declassified. You know, it's going to be for your eyes only type shit, burn after reading type shit. They're not going. It's not going to be sitting around in a database to be released. But nevertheless, there's a lot of incredible stuff out there that has been revealed through FOIAs. So we're going to have John Greenwald on, and I met him at Contact in the Desert, which is a UFO festival, of all things. And yeah, they filled out a whole database about the newly released JFK files, which were mostly disappointing. Not their database, but the release of the files was mostly disappointing because there was really not a lot there that we didn't already know. I think there was only like 50 files that were released that hadn't previously been out there in some way. So a lot of the good stuff was either redacted or just not released. Apparently there was a pretty massive blitz by intelligence agencies during that week, after which Trump had announced he was going to release the files. And they pretty much told him, like, no, don't do it. And he could have still done it, but he didn't. So yeah, we're going to have Greenwald on from the Black Vault, and then at some point I'm going to have my buddy Frank on, and Frank is an interesting guy. He's helping me with my documentary. He's helping me do some research on a case, and he's an interesting guy because I was talking to him one time over a beer, and he told me that, you know, his family is from El Salvador, and his father had been around during the kind of CIA instigated coup there. And for those of you who don't know, the CIA has initiated many coups over the years. Many efforts to topple socialist our communist-leaning governments, or just left-leaning governments. And usually they end up, you know, setting up a, you know, U.S.-friendly puppet dictator who will do whatever the hell they want them to do. So this it'll be an interesting story to have Frank tell us, because a lot of times you hear about these kind of, you know, nefarious things the CIA has done in Central and Latin American countries and South American countries, which make any kind of Russian meddling in our election look like amateur hour. I mean, it's just nothing compared to what we've done in some of these countries. So yeah, we're gonna have that. That'll be the next couple weeks. This week is just pretty open. In fact, it looks like I don't even know if my co-host is gonna be calling in tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, it may just be me and you for the next 50 minutes. But that's all right. I can sit here and talk to myself. I don't mind. Another weird day. Another day of learning that people that you might look up to are kind of shitty people, which we're finding out now pretty much every day. As the fallout, the cultural fallout from the Weinstein scandal continues to ripple, as more and more women come out and have the courage to describe what's happened to them and name names of people that need to be looked into. This time around, it is another politician, a Democratic senator who I've actually previously quite liked, Al Franken. He's a comedian. He was on SNL for a long time. He's written a lot of funny books. And yeah, I always kind of liked Al Franken. I mean, I haven't liked him too much in the last kind of 5 years or so, because I've seen him push to the center like so many other Democrats have. And, you know, he came out in support of fracking. He came out in support of Hillary Clinton. And, yeah, he's just kind of turned into kind of a wonk, like a mainstream centrist wonk. And now it turns out that he's done some bad stuff. He, you know, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more. I think most people have done bad things. Most people have done things they don't, that they regret. But there's different tiers to that, you know. There's certainly a difference between, you know, rape and womanizing, for instance. You know, there's a lot of men who sleep with a lot of women, and, you know, depending on your ethical standards, there's not necessarily anything wrong with sleeping around, you know, if that's what you want to do. It's a free country, as long as you have consent from people. Now, of course, when you get into breaking hearts and breaking people's feelings, that gets into a different story, but still different situation than non-consensual sex. And in this particular situation, Franken is not accused of he's not accused of rape. And to an extent, I don't even think he's accused of sexual assault. So basically, a journalist or a TV host, radio host, by the name of Leanne Tweeden, came out and said that when she was doing a USO tour to entertain the troops with Franken back in 2006, that essentially Franken had forcibly kissed her. So, okay, that would pretty sure that would qualify as sexual assault. Basically, Franken wrote some sketch in which he kissed her. I don't know what the context of the sketch is. And then invited her backstage beforehand to rehearse it. And she says, "When I saw the script, Franken had written a moment when his character comes at me for a kiss. I suspected what he was after, but I figured I could turn my head at the last minute or put my hand over his mouth to get more laughs from the crowd." According to Tweeden, Franken insisted on rehearsing the kiss backstage and continued to insist over her protestations until she agreed so he would stop badgering her. "We did the line leading up to the kiss, and then he came at me, put his mouth on the back of my head, mashed his lips against mine, and aggressively stuck his tongue in my mouth. I immediately pushed him away with both of my hands against his chest and told him if he ever did that to me again, I wouldn't be so nice about it next time." It wasn't until I was back in the U.S. and looking through the CD of photos we were given by the photography that I saw this one. And now what she's referring to is a very distasteful photo of a seemingly asleep Tweeden and Al Franken kind of jokingly approaching her with both hands out as if to touch her, and he's looking back at the camera. So now he's clearly aware that he's being photographed. I felt violated all over again, embarrassed, belittled, humiliated. How dare anyone grab my breasts like this and think it's funny? Now here's where I'm a little confused, because I didn't know he was actually touching her. It's kind of hard to tell if he's actually touching her or not. But, you know, I mean, it kind of matters, you know, a little bit. Kind of doesn't matter. Politically, it doesn't matter, I don't think, because it's such a distasteful picture. And, you know, but I guess from a legal standpoint, it kind of would matter if someone's actually touching her or not. But she says, "I couldn't believe it. He groped me without my consent while I was asleep." So yeah, this is just, you know, all right. Tweeden issued a direct statement to Franken. "Senator Franken, you wrote the script, but there's nothing funny about sexual assault. You knew exactly what you were doing. You forcibly kissed me without my consent, grabbed my breasts while I was sleeping, and had someone take a photo of you doing it, knowing I would see it later and be ashamed." Yeah, that sounds pretty bad. Certainly looks bad. I mean, it's, God. Franken must be in the doghouse tonight. And, of course, it doesn't help that Franken has been such a outspoken, well, actually, it's a good thing. He's been an outspoken critic of people who have abused women. I mean, that's a good thing, but sure makes him seem like a hypocrite now. And of course, as has been the case with recent people, Franca did not do a good job with the apology. So his first apology went like this. "I certainly don't remember the rehearsal for the skit in the same way, but I send my sincerest apologies to Leanne. As to the photo, it was clearly intended to be funny, but wasn't. I shouldn't have done it." Okay, yeah, that's a bad apology. That's a bad apology. Not as bad as Kevin Spacey basically blaming or contextualizing his attempted abuse of a minor by saying that he's gay, which is essentially what Kevin Spacey did last week. God, was that really only last week? Man, all this stuff is starting to, I mean, this is just getting insane. This is just, this is out of control. And of course, we all knew this was the case. You know, most men are assholes. Most women are assholes too, but men are predatory assholes. And many of them have positions of power, which makes their assholedom worse. So Franken had a more recent apology. It is better. But I don't even care about reading it. It doesn't matter. His political career is certainly in jeopardy. My guess would be that if no more reports come out, which is to say if there isn't a precipitous group of women coming out against him, which is what's been happening, my guess is that with Thanksgiving coming up, it's possible he can weather this, at least until next year and he's up for re-election. That'll be a different story. But man, the list is getting long. The list is getting long, and we're going to have to start really thinking hard about how we want to start reacting to this, because I don't know. I mean, this is a major social problem, cultural problem. It's in every industry. Journalists are going down. Directors, producers are going down. Politicians are going down. Chefs are going down. I mean, it's just been pretty much every industry. And it's just another issue that gets politicized, of course. Liberals want to blame conservatives. Conservatives want to blame liberals. But it's everyone, apparently. It's across the political spectrum. We need some new morality. We need new ethics. And I'm going to be making a point for us building out a kind of new way of looking at the future, which is to say that we need a new way of organizing ourselves that is not based on religion, political ideology, or even hobbies. We need a way of organizing communities that is based on respect and building towards a better humanity. Now, I think what we need is transhumanist agorism. Now, what the hell is that, you say? Well, I'm going to explain it, but it's going to take a little while. So, and you'll ask, how does this even connect? What is the connection between sexual scandals and transhumanist agorism? Well, I think people are morally lost right now. You know, we're living in a time where we're surrounded with commercialism and temptation, because the whole society we're living right now is based around conspicuous consumption, perpetual consumption. You need to keep buying all the newest things, all the newest gadgets, all the newest apps. But there's no limit to it, it's not satisfying anyone. There's never a point where someone's going to be like, all right, I have enough gadgets. No, the whole point of capitalism, you have to keep creating the new gadget. And, you know, companies like Apple and other tech companies, they even have a term for it. It's called planned obsolescence. And that is gadgets that are basically designed to fail after a certain amount of time, so you'd have to buy the next gadget. So it's written right into the code of consumption that you have to keep consuming, you have to keep getting the next thing over and over and over again. And to an extent, there's a biological model for it too, with our own sexuality. You know, sexuality, libido, never goes away. It's right back the next time. It's always there. So these men, and women too, but in this case, men, they have this itch that they keep having to scratch over and over and over again. And they're never going to be done with it. So what do we do? Well, we have to embrace technology. We can't run away from technology at this point. Transhumanism is on its way, and to a certain extent, it's already here. Now, of course, transhumanism is an intellectual movement. It's also kind of an industry, but it's aimed at transforming the human condition by developing technologies that can enhance not only our intellect, but our physiology. Now, transhumanist thinkers, and I've interviewed, a couple of them, only one for an anti-media article. I interviewed Zoltan Isteban, who was running for president last year under the transhumanist ticket. And he's an interesting guy. Very interesting guy. But transhumanist thinkers, essentially, the idea behind transhumanism, or at least the kind of transhumanism that I'm interested in, is that we can overcome some human limitations, ethical and physical. Now, the most obvious definition of a physical limitation overcome by transhumanism would be there's technology now that can help deaf people hear. There's implants now that can simulate the vibrations in the eardrum to help a deaf person hear. There are prosthetic limbs for people. The pacemaker, in fact, was one of the very first transhumanist technologies. And these are obviously good things. It's hard to argue against a technology that allows a deaf person to hear, or a blind person to see, or a disabled person to walk. But then you get into some ethical gray areas when you start getting to things like mental health. I've been pretty open about the fact that I've, suffer from depression and bipolar type 2. And a lot of people do. And a lot of people are desperately searching for help from pharmaceuticals, from therapy. And to a certain extent, pharmaceuticals can help, but they're certainly not a cure. So let's say that a scientist comes and says, "Look, I've got this little chip that we're going to put in your head, and it's going to make you feel better." It's kind of a scary thing to put a computer chip inside your head. Is it going to change me completely? Is the government going to be tracking me? Am I still going to be myself? There's a lot of things to be worried about when you think about putting a chip inside your head. Will I still be human? That's a question people still ask. And then when you have transhumanists talking about the idea of being post-human, that makes you think even more. One definition: transhumanism is a class of philosophies that seek to guide us towards a post-human condition. Transhumanism shares many elements of humanism, including a respect for reason and science, a commitment to progress, and a valuing of human existence in this life. Now, this is overlapping, of course, with artificial intelligence. Which at this point is still algorithmic. We don't have strong artificial intelligence yet. We will, but not yet. So at this point, artificial intelligence is still just like an assistance. Okay, so there's your definition of transhumanism. The augmentation of human race with technologies like nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, to a certain extent, simulated reality, artificial intelligence, bioprinting, mind uploading. How is it going to help us? Well, physically, it could help with a lot of illnesses. Mentally, it could help with a lot of illnesses. It could help people with mental illness. It could help them overcome it. And to a certain extent, that needs to be up to the individual. If someone doesn't feel well psychologically, it should be up to them, whether if there's a solution out there that can help them, why not? But you get into that ethical gray area, which is, what is the government's role going to be in this new digital age? Will we lose our human identity? What will the socioeconomic effects be? You know, transhumanism is very often a thinly disguised kind of libertarian economics. And some critics of it have said that, you know, there will likely be socioeconomic consequences, further divisions between the rich and the poor, in which the very rich will be able to afford these new technologies and live, you know, these vastly improved lives and potentially longer lives. You know, life extension is certainly within the purview of transhumanism. And in, it's long been a trope of dystopian science fiction that people in the future who have money will be able to live longer. Money will buy you a longer life, as opposed to poor people who will be sick and not able to live as long. There's also the potential for what's called coercive eugenicism, which is to say, controlling human biology, I guess would be the best way to say it. So, if you can reprogram the genes of humans, as in biotechnology, gene editing and stuff like that, which we're already seeing gene editing starting to rear its head. You know, if humans can start controlling their genetics, how will that not lead to a form of eugenics? Now, the major transhumanist organizations that condemn coercion, and they reject the racist and classist assumptions. But, you know, I think it's a very legitimate point. Of course, there's also existential risks with transhumanism. The most popular one that I can think of right now would be the gray goo theory. Now, gray goo, it's a hypothetical involving nanotechnology. Whereas if you have a nanobot that reproduces itself, it leaves behind a little bit of detritus or goo, and if it keeps reproducing itself, you get this the specter of this gray goo inhabiting all of the earth. Yeah, I don't feel like going into a longer description of it, but there is the chance that recursive nanotechnology could get out of hand and leave behind an environmental mess. Now, of course, there's people that believe that it's the opposite, that nanotechnology is actually going to enable us to clean up environmental messes. In fact, there's a lot of people think that nanotechnology and transhuman technology will allow us to essentially suck the carbon out of the atmosphere. I don't know. Now, on the other hand, you have agorism. Now, agorism is another libertarian social philosophy. And this one advocates creating a society in which all relations between people are voluntary exchanges. It's a form of counter-economics. And the biggest spokesman of it that I know is Derek Bros, and he writes for the Anti-Media. And, you know, essentially agorism is, it's not the same as anarchism. They often are in the same circles. But, you know, it is a form of counter-economics. I'm trying to find a good definition of agorism because it's kind of hard to explain. All right, let me find this here. All right, agorism is revolutionary market anarchism. God, that's cool sounding. In a market anarchist society, law and security would be provided by market actors instead of political institutions. Agorists recognize that situation cannot develop through political reform, and said it will arise as a result of market processes. Okay, that didn't help me at all. I don't like that definition. Still looking for a good definition of this. Wait, I think I just found one on Reddit. All right. Agorism is a revolutionary left libertarian political philosophy that advocates the goal of bringing about society. No, that's the same definition that I was reading before. Good Lord in heaven. All right, well, here's a good definition of counter-economics. Counter-economics is the sum of all non-aggressive human action, which is forbidden by the state. So the counter-economy would include the free market, the black market, the underground economy, all acts of civil and social disobedience, all acts of forbidden association, and anything else the state in any place or any time chooses to prohibit, control, regulate, tax, or tariff. The counter-economy excludes all state-approved action. Although very similar to anarcho-capitalism, ooh, I don't like that. Agorism is explicitly opposed to political elections and parliamentary strategies. Some agorists oppose intellectual property. Some allow for certain forms of intellectual property. Okay, well, I'm struggling to find a good definition of it. And I've listened to many speeches and lectures about agorism. For some reason, the only thought that comes to my head, the visual I get when I think of agorism is like a farmer's market or like a potluck. But imagine a potluck expanded by a million times. And it not just involving food, but also industry and all the things that humans need. That would be agorism. A really big potluck. They promote withdrawing from the state and using counter-economic activities to minimize what a person contributes to the state in the form of taxes. So, to get back to my earlier point, which was we may be headed towards a kind of transhumanist agorism, will people be able to withdraw from the state while still providing for the weakest among us? That's the question I have. And that's the question that's never really answered by libertarians or anarchists or agorists. How can we provide for those of us who cannot provide for themselves? Now, the answer that you'll usually hear is that, well, people will voluntarily do it as a kind of charity. I don't know, that scares me a little bit, because we know that that's not always the case. Many, many people will be left behind. Now, in an age in which we have the resources to take care of everyone, and yet so many people aren't taken care of, my fear with eradicating the state would be that we would go through a dark age. Even if we were eventually going to get to a better place where a counter-economic model could provide for everyone, to get to that point, we're going to have to go through a dark age where so many people are going to be left behind. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. You know, we're witnessing, we're a part of this human experiment right now. That's what we're a part of. This is the same human experiment that was going on 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, or just 200 years ago. You know, this is an alien experiment where creatures on a planet flying through space with these just demented brains. And it kind of ties into the whole sexual harassment thing, because we still have not figured out a way to voluntarily live. We still treat each other like shit. In the free economy, people still treat each other like shit, because the free economy, which is to say, or the free society, the society outside of that which is modulated by the state, that's our own personal behavior on a day-to-day basis. You can't blame that on the government. People like to blame the government for everything. And to be fair, there's a lot to blame the government for. But don't blame the government for us being assholes. That's just us. That's who we are. You can choose to not be an asshole. You can choose not to be a predator. Of course, some people will even argue with that. They'll say, no, these people's brains are wired differently. They have a sickness, as with a pedophile. A pedophile probably is not choosing to be a pedophile, because why would you want to live that life? It's a hideous sickness. That's how they were wired. So what do you do with those people? If you were to get rid of the state, how would you bring people like that to justice? That's the question I always end up having for anarchists too. Now, I would identify myself as an anarcho-syndicalist. And anarcho-syndicalism is a theory of anarchism that views revolutionary industrial unionism or syndicalism as a method for workers in a capitalist society to gain control of an economy and control and influence a broader society. So it's essentially a strategy that's facilitating worker self-activity in a cooperative, a kind of alternative cooperative economic system. But it still has some of the democratic values and production. Solidarity, direct action, direct democracy, worker self-management. Syndicalism wants to abolish the wage system, and have the state, the primary purpose of the state being the defense of private property. It's a complex, system. It's not a pure worker state, anarcho-syndicalism. So it's not like a Marxist or Leninist theory. You know, anarcho-syndicalists believe that power corrupts, and decentralized egalitarian control is where it's at. Now, I like that phrase, decentralized egalitarian control. And that's kind of where I'm headed with my definition of what a transhumanist agorist state would be. Now, we need decentralization, and we're starting to get that on an economic level when you look at things like Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the blockchain. There's a lot of different altcoins out there now. I'm invested in a few: Bitcoin, Ethereum, Nexus. But that's really just the very start of decentralization. Now, Derek Bros, who I mentioned before, did a whole tour this year that was actually sponsored by Bitcoin, and was called the Decentralize Your Life Tour. And Derek Bros is an agorist, but he very much believes that spreading the ideas of decentralization is the start of a larger revolution that we need as humanity, which is seizing control of the economy from the state, from crony corporations and cronyism in general, and building power from the bottom up instead of from the top down. And I think this is connected actually to some of these sexual scandals, because when people without power are seizing power in the form of free speech that dismantles power, that's an exercise of decentralized control. Or decentralized, Hollywood is being decentralized right now to an extent. Maybe not in terms of who's making the financial decisions, but people sitting in their executive chair who thought they could do anything they want, including grope someone or rape someone, they can't do that anymore. They're not going to be able to, because they're risking their life now. You're risking your career now in a very major way. Before, when you did it, they were certain they would get away with it. They would think, okay, worst case scenario, this comes out as a headline, we pay the person off or we threaten them and they shut up and we're able to bury the headline. Okay, not so much anymore. Because there's strength in numbers now. One person comes out, then another person comes out, and before you know it, it's this trickle effect that's cascaded, an avalanche, and your career is screwed. Major, powerful people are being avalanched right now. Harvey Weinstein is one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. You know that old phrase, "You won't work in this town again"? Okay, that's what the producers used to say to the underlings if the underlings did something wrong or talked back. you won't work in this town again. Well, now we can say that to the producer himself. Harvey Weinstein will not work in that town again. Very unlikely. Very difficult to see how Harvey Weinstein is ever going to work in Hollywood again. His name is toxic. He has zero social capital. In fact, he has negative social capital. Kevin Spacey, to a certain extent, not as bad of a downfall as Harvey Weinstein, but pretty bad. He got House of Cards taken away from him. His movie was canceled. He was recast in the movie All the Money in the World. He was dropped from his agency. I mean, he lost everything. Now, he may be able to turn it around because, as far as I know, the accusations against him, while they are bad, oh no, actually, Kevin Spacey may be gone because, yeah, there were like 30 people saying that he sexually harassed them on set, so he may be gone. But some of these other people, like Louis C.K., I think, is someone who could probably turn it around. He's going to have to be gone for a while. You won't be seeing anything from Louis C.K. in a while. And what he did is really bad. He basically cornered women and masturbated in front of them. But 10 years from now, I could see him making a comeback on some kind of self-awareness comedy tour. Who knows? I don't know. But I don't feel the least bit bad for these people. It's a hideous human quality to use your power to make other people feel uncomfortable and assault. I mean, it's just, there's no defense of it. It's absolutely despicable. But this is decentralizing Hollywood to an extent. So where are we at? What have I been rambling about for the past hour? Oh, transhumanist agorism. So yeah, we need to, I think there's a connection between these sexual scandals and the larger state of where we're at, which is, this is about egalitarianism. This is about redesigning society in a way so that the people at the top are not able to abuse and exploit the people on the bottom. So everything that's happening in Hollywood, that same stuff happens on a much larger scale at the world at large, with giant corporations exploiting workers, giant agricultural companies exploiting farmers. Is it a reach? I don't know. I think this is about exploitation. And fortunately, we're finally seeing a very real movement of people standing out and saying, we're just not going to take it anymore. Now, is this a transferable movement? Can we see this same thing happen in other industries and in other aspects of our life in terms of, let's have the workers stand up and say, we're not going to take this anymore, and start laying out the transgressions of big corporations. To a certain extent, the Black Lives Matter movement, that's people at the ground level saying, we're not going to tolerate these abuses by the cops anymore. This is part of, I'm telling you, this is part of a larger movement. Of people saying, enough is enough. But we all have to work on ourselves. And we all have to figure out a way that we can survive in this world. Some of us may need transhumanism. Some of us may need to modulate the way we think a little bit. We all have the right to feel the way we want to feel. I think that's a human right. Now, I do think we got to be careful with chips and whatnot. You know, we don't want to get too crazy, but at the same time, you know, the human race is headed towards much bigger things, I think, in the future. You know, think about what things will be like in 1,000 years from now. 1,000 years. We'll be post-human by then. I don't think you're going to see humans walking around. You're going to see bandwidth. You're going to see people. People will be algorithms in a computer. But man, for right now, we are not algorithms. Right now, we are living, breathing creatures trying to figure out how to treat each other in a decent way. And we're not doing a very good job of it. We are not doing a good job of it. But I have faith. In the meantime, I think let's just try and do the best we can. Love the ones around you. Try and be a good person. Still possible. Still possible to be a good person. I hope. So yeah. A little bit of mind jazz for you there. So like I said, coming up in the next couple weeks, we'll have some good guests. In the meantime, like I said, let's practice being good people.
I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.